This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.
What is happening is that our ability to engage critically a thing that is hard grows when we stick to it. I think that we have lost that ability, and so we get to play the my feelings are hurt card when everybody's feelings are hurt about something. Many people are offended about something. We don't necessarily talk about what it means to resist the urge to be offended long enough to engage in a creative and helpful dialogue.
The Village Square, a nervy bunch of liberals and conservatives who believe that disagreement and dialogue make for a good conversation, a good country, and a good time. At the Village Square, we talk about politics, religion, and race. You know, the topics your mom taught you never to discuss in polite company. Listen, at the Village Square, we make pigs fly.
Hey folks, welcome to Village Squarecast. This is Corey Nathan, and I am so glad to be with you again. Thank you for joining us for Everyone is Canceled with our beloved God Squad. Funding for this program was provided through a grant from Florida Humanities with funds from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Check out Florida Humanities online at floridahumanities.org. In this edition of Village Squarecast, the God Squad will be tackling an issue that's affected us all, whether it's folks who don't know what words to use and what words not to use, or individuals who go completely the other way and seem to embrace this brazen set of, I guess I'll call them anti-virtues, where screaming is the norm instead of speaking, where hatefulness is celebrated instead of being neighborly. So we have a bunch of us who are always wondering if we're going to get scolded for saying the wrong thing, and others who celebrate being offensive as if they think they're scoring points for their supposed side. So how are we to live free in a culture that's this hostile and toxic to diverse opinions? Enter the God Squad. I'm really looking forward to this talk where we can explore whether virtues like grace and patience and kindness and giving each other the benefit of the doubt to do what's right by their beliefs while still holding space for deep disagreements among us. This great discussion is facilitated by Stephanie Posner of Temple Israel, and everyone gets to introduce themselves, so I will not be redundant by doing so now. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Stephanie, and I'll see you on the other side.
So I say, while we're waiting for Pastor Joe to arrive, let's go down the line and everybody do a quick introduction of themselves.
Father Tim Holita from Co-Cathedral St. Thomas More.
Betsy Willett-Zierden, retired United Methodist minister and spiritual director, and recently just had my first Village Square small group at my home, and it was amazing. So much fun.
I'm Paul Sidlovsky. I'm a rabbi of Temple Israel here in Tallahassee.
Gary Schultz, I'm the senior pastor here at First Baptist.
Latricia Scriven, senior pastor at St. Paul's United Methodist Church, where we worship, grow, serve, share, and give with joy.
Okay, so according to the Pew Research Center, cancel culture is a movement to remove celebrity status or esteem from a person, place, or thing based on offensive behavior or transgression. When we think about a person who might have committed an offense that leads to them being canceled, how do you, as religious leaders, weigh your role to guide people in higher moral and ethical values with making the decision to count them out?
I just would say that...
Don't look at me like that.
I don't want to count anyone out ever, so...
I thinking about this topic, I'm reminded of a line from our High Holy Day liturgy in our prayer book that says that God does not want the death of sinners, but God wants them to change their ways. So rather than looking to cancel people or get rid of them in any kind of way, we should be looking at addressing behaviors. So we could disagree with behaviors, but that doesn't mean we have to be hate the other person or avoid the other person, because that doesn't solve anything.
I mean, there is a certain amount of nuance to this discussion. I mean, there needs to be a balance or a healthy tension between moral outrage at certain things, and yet, as a Christian, forgiveness. You know, the idea of canceling somebody is inherently negative, and of course, that it looks different for who that person is and what that person experiences. So there's a lot of nuance there, and yet there does need to be a tension looking at, well, what will we tolerate and how do we forgive and what does that look like, particularly on a wider social scale? So it's a loaded discussion because all of those things are subjective. But as a faith leader, ultimately you want to lead someone toward forgiveness.
Through the subjectivity of it all, I think that healing, transformation, opportunities to show how to be more loving take place when we find ways to count people in rather than looking for reasons to count them out.
I have a lot of thoughts. It's kind of hard to organize them all on this. I think for one, there's the definition that was just read of cancel culture, but I think what we've seen and what we've experienced, at least I've read about in the news or whatever, is when people, they don't just get canceled, so to speak, or deplatformed or unable to speak, but often their livelihood is taken away. People get doxxed. They find out where someone works. They pressure the business to fire them. All of those sort of things happen too. So that's like, to me, when I think of cancel culture, I think of a broader definition of that. I think a lot of this has to do with context too. And part of the problem here is it's social media. So an easy solution to all these things is if we just don't use social media, that'd be awesome. Which I think our legislature's trying to force on kids, I guess, I don't know. I'm not gonna weigh in on all that. But I'm not a big social media guy. But like, it would be inappropriate for someone, let's say, to come in here and start screaming, right? We have free speech, but it's inappropriate for someone to come in here and start talking, right? This is not the context or the appropriate venue for someone to come in here and just start yelling or drowning us out or whatever. So how do we balance, like, what is the appropriate context for someone to be able to speak their mind? And I'm not afraid of error, and I'm not afraid of people who disagree with me or have different views. And I think we should, you know, I think there's a kind of a reaction to, we have to shut people down or not allow them to speak and so on. And I don't think that's the right response all the time. I think we can comment on someone's speech or views, and we can have a debate. We can have an argument, persuade people, I feel is more effective than just shutting them down. I think that leads to more attention to somebody, and also it kind of creates a kind of reaction as well that might give them more attention, perhaps, than if you just allow them to speak and sound stupid.
Well, and to build on that, there is a decided lack of grace that usually takes place in these discussions. I mean, we seem to live in a culture where increasingly we just want to go for the jugular of somebody that we disagree with. We want to silence them. We want to shut them down. We want to cancel them instead of having any type of discussion or learning or training or redemption, to use a spiritual term. We just instantly want to cut it out, get rid of it. And that makes it very difficult to have any kind of nuance in those kind of discussions, to treat people as people, as people ought to be treated.
So let me ask you this. What is the criteria for being canceled, and who makes that decision?
Well, that's kind of, I think, what I'm saying. Like, I don't, I think it depends on the context, right? So again, I'm trying to just think off, like, again, like, if someone came in here, it might not be appropriate just to say whatever they want, right? But I feel like I should be able to, in this role, kind of say things. If it offends some people, I'm sorry, but I don't think you need to be afraid of that and run from that. Like, I would rather have a conversation about things like that. This is the difficulty, right? Where do we draw the line and who makes those decisions in a pluralistic society about what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate? There's probably things that I could say that would offend people, I guess. I'm sure there's things you could say that could offend people, but who draws the line and what is like socially acceptable? I think that's a challenge. It's hard to define, I think, these things. We want to have legalistic sort of norms and like rules, because then we can control things and they seem neat and orderly. But I just don't think living in a democracy and a pluralistic society, it's probably not very realistic.
You gonna say something, Latricia?
I wasn't.
Well, maybe you'll say something now, because I was actually gonna ask you to elaborate here. Are we being too sensitive?
Sometimes. So as a person whose background was mathematics before coming into the space of ministry, I used to tell my students all the time that I think, you know, how are we going to use this math, right? Is that what is happening is that our ability to engage critically a thing that is hard grows when we stick to it. I think that we have lost that ability, and so we get to play the "my feelings are hurt" card when everybody's feelings are hurt about something. Many people are offended about something. We don't necessarily talk about what it means to resist the urge to be offended long enough to engage in a creative and helpful dialogue. Many times we're not having conversations with people. We're giving snippets online about and to people we've never met. We do not know. We're not engaging humanity. We're engaging words on a screen very often. And holding individuals to a standard that we will not hold ourselves to. Because we have standards for them, and we have standards for ourselves, and our standard for ourselves say that I'm not a bad person. I may have said the wrong thing in that moment, or I was in a mood, or you know what? I've grown since I made that statement. But to other people, we characterize their entirety of their humanity by a snippet of what was said. So yes, I think that's a long answer to saying I do think that we are sometimes too sensitive because we have not learned the skills to have effective conversation where we hear each other and try to understand. Because I can't really truly disagree with you if I don't understand what it is you're saying in the first place.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I agree with everything that you said. And in addition to not learning the skills, I think there's something even a deeper level to that. A lot of people don't want to learn the skills. They are very happy being in their own silo, their own area, and there isn't respectful dialogue. And the way I look at it is that if that is the case, how do any of us grow? We don't grow. We don't learn anything. By listening to other people, by hearing other opinions. It doesn't mean we have to necessarily agree, but maybe we'll learn something. Even if we end up disagreeing in the end, maybe we hear something that makes us think a little differently, or maybe we gain a little more respect for that person because they have something to offer even if we don't agree. That's not always the case. I don't believe that anything goes and everyone's right and that type of thing, but people have a right to express their opinion and people should be willing to discuss it. I know that Jewish tradition, for example, is based on a lot of dialogue. And in the Talmud, which is the Jewish oral law in addition to the Torah and the Bible, there is lengthy discussion that takes place. I mean, the Talmud is volumes and volumes. It would take up bookshelves to have it all. And what it is discussion. And what's really interesting is the discussion includes the dissenting views. It doesn't leave it out. It doesn't cancel it. It actually includes it and puts it there. And then they list the prevailing view last so you know what the actual decision is. And occasionally say, we can't decide. We just don't come to an answer, there's different views. But the idea that the dissenting view, the one that's not agreed to in the end, is still there means that there is respect for that view and there's something to be learned from that view. And that's how we need to treat things. As long as it's done respectfully and, you know, with good intentions and with the understanding that people are different, then other opposing views are not only okay, but very helpful. So, yes, we are sometimes too sensitive because we, as you said, cut it off before we even have a chance to learn what the other person has to say or is thinking.
So I read a phrase today that said, in the Jewish tradition, we have argument for the sake of heaven.
Yeah, okay, yes. So there's a distinction there, and I won't go into great detail, but there's a distinction between arguments for the sake of heaven and arguments that are not for the sake of heaven. And they give examples of both. The argument that's not for the sake of heaven is, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Korach in the book of Numbers, where he argues against Moses, but he is saying that Moses' leadership is questionable because he really wants to be the leader himself. But he disguises it in the idea that Moses is not representing all of you. I will represent all of you. That's not for the sake of heaven. The argument is between two rabbis, Hillel and Shammai, 2,000 years ago, who had a debate about how to light the candles for Hanukkah, whether you light one candle the first night and add one each night, or whether you start with all of them and take away one. And the custom now, for anyone who you know observes Hanukkah, knows you start with one and you add because you want to increase light. But Shammai now sounds like he's crazy. Like, what's he doing the opposite for? But no, he had the idea that it's based on the story of the miracle of the oil. The oil was found enough to last for one day, and it actually lasted for eight. That's the story in the Talmud of the miracle. And so Shammai wanted to represent the decreasing oil each night. So there's a reason for it. You know, it's not just, I just want to do the opposite of what you're doing. So if you just said, oh, Shammai, you're canceled. You know, forget it. We don't want to hear your point of view. You wouldn't think about that and say, oh, well, that's part of the story.
I just, when I read that, I thought, what a lovely phrase that is, argument for the sake of heaven. And we're talking about we've been hearing about the importance of dialogue. And one thing that I heard you say, Rabbi, is that people are happy in their silos. I don't think they're happy so much personally as I think that we've lost the art of conversation. We've lost the art of dialogue. We don't have dinner table discussions around our dinner tables with our children or with our spouses. I think that people don't have the skills, similar to what you were saying, Latricia. You know, they have to be taught the skills to stay involved. And along with not being able to have a conversation comes not being able to have an argument, comes not being able to think critically.
Can I just throw one more thing in? So we're hearing a lot of conversation about conversation. So what I want to ask you is to develop this thought a little bit more around behaviors. So actions that people have taken and not necessarily just what they've said. Where is that line? Is it criminal behavior that cancels a person? Harvey Weinstein.
He should be canceled.
Okay, but I'll give you another one. Kanye West.
Kanye West.
He wasn't.
It depends on
your gang.
Depends on your crew. But Harvey Weinstein is a good example of somebody who has committed behaviors and actions. And is that the line we're looking for?
Well, I think that raises
an important... I thought you didn't give up on anybody.
I don't give up.
Don't throw anybody out. I'm just throwing that out there.
I know, but to be perfectly frank, I don't think the whole topic about being canceled is really as profound as it may appear on the surface, because I think it's reductionist in its description. So Harvey Weinstein needs to be brought to justice and kept from hurting people. And it doesn't mean that he's canceled as a human being, and hopefully he has a great rabbi that is working with him, and he has an opportunity for repentance. So what are we even talking about when we say canceled? Is it because of that country western, is that a genre? The song, you know the song?
Yeah.
We talked about the song.
We talked about it a couple months ago?
Yeah, a couple months ago. Well, that's how this conversation started. Mm-hmm. So tell us. What do you remember?
Is it in a small town?
Something like that.
Old little town or something?
I don't know. Try that in a small town. Is that what it was?
Did we talk about it a little bit? We did.
But there is a difference, and I think we're struggling with that between a celebrity and somebody that we're in a relationship with, or somebody that we consider a normal person. There's also a difference between something that's criminal and something that someone said that was either dumb or offensive.
Yes.
And that's where we're trying to have a lot of different conversations at once. And Betsy, you're right. To reduce it to something overall makes that very, very difficult. I know for me, based on what Harvey Weinstein did, I don't want to consume his art anymore. But there are other artists who have said things that or done things that I find very offensive, but not on that level. And again, I think that's something that's subjective for different people. There are certain things that I hope that just about everybody could agree on, and what Weinstein did, I hope would be in that category. But even there's a distinction between how I might treat a celebrity and then how I might treat somebody in my church or someone in my neighborhood, a friend, and how we would relate and work with that person. And I think that's an important part of this discussion. For the most part, the people that we interact with, we're going to want to keep that relationship, do the hard work of being in a relationship, and lead them toward hopefully some kind of restoration, I would hope, whatever that is able to look like. But that's very different than how I might interpret or interact with a celebrity who has done something that's easy for me to write off.
I want to add, as a proposal, like there's like unwritten rules perhaps here with us, right? That we're generally trying to have a type of conversation here, and we respect one another and so on. So like, again, like certain things would not be appropriate here, and if we did it, we would be canceled, so to speak, from God Squad, right? Like we wouldn't be allowed to come back because we're not following the rules. Does that make sense? So I think that people, again, like I think everybody needs to have the right, and I think Jefferson would agree with me, you know, like that we need to have the people need to have the freedom to express themselves, and it could be awful and horrible or good or whatever, somewhere in between. But that doesn't mean they should be able to do that everywhere. And there's certain rules, and there should be a place for that. On the flip side, everyone should also have the right to not listen, right? So if it's on social media, which I think most of this kind of takes place, you know, I think there should be a space for people to be able to speak freely, but there should be just as equal a right for people to turn that off, right? Not have to listen to that. But I don't think we need to be afraid of someone's opposing views. In our church recently, there's always controversy in the Catholic Church. You may know this. And you go back to the New Testament, you're going to see conflict and arguments. And I have parishioners who get nervous about that, like, well, the church is divided. I'm like, there's always been discussion. There's always been debate, much like what Paul was saying in our faith and our background. And it's okay. We don't need to be afraid of that. And when the Pope has a synod and invites people to speak, who might be okay with women's ordination or different things or changes in the church, like that's okay. It doesn't mean things are going to change, but we don't have to be afraid of someone's thoughts, right? We can engage in that. We don't need to be afraid of that. I think that's a good, but there's the context, right? Like, where is this appropriate for this time or not? And I think that's sort of the kind of the discussion. One little caveat, like with Harvey Weinstein, I think again, it's all about freedom in some ways, right? Like
You could say Chris Brown too.
Chris Brown, okay. Okay, he was a musical artist? Is that the guy? Yeah, okay. So should people listen to his music or not? You know, I mean, I think someone should have the right to say, I don't want to play it because of what he's associated with. But can we, like, I'm, believe it or not, this might be hard for you to believe, but like, I'm not perfect. Okay. And believe it or not, like there's definitely, I guarantee every single one of us here, if we sat down, we're going to find something we disagree on. Does that mean I should be totally tuned out? Does that taint everything I've ever done? Is art separate from the person? Like those are very interesting philosophical conversations, but I don't want someone forcing me to not listen to somebody or forcing me not to listen to someone's music or watch their films. And I also don't think someone should be forced to play them either. So I think, to me, that's what it kind of comes down to.
And just to dovetail on that, I mean, I agree that this has come up with musicians. There's been a Jewish debate for years about Wagner, you know, a great musician, but terrible anti-Semite, and, you know, a lot of Jews would say, I'll never listen. Then we have comedians like Bill Cosby, Woody Allen, you know, people like that who were loved, respected by many people, and now, you know, absolutely hated by many people, and things like that. We have restaurant chains that people will boycott Chick-fil-A or other stores, Hobby Lobby or other things like that, for their views. But when one group makes a big fuss and says, we're boycotting Chick-fil-A, I guarantee you, because I've seen it, there's a line around the block at Chick-fil-A. So you're not canceling them by doing this. You might be feeling, you know, righteous indignation if you don't agree with what they stand for, but you are certainly not canceling them. You're not making, you know, and if anything, you might be actually increasing support for them. So it's one thing to say, like, I won't listen to the music, I won't eat at this place, I won't do that. That's your personal choice. But to get angry at other people and then stack a whole bunch of assumptions on that person, you eat at this restaurant, you listen to that artist, therefore you're a this, you're a that, or you don't care about this. It's too much, because it is not who the person is. It's one particular view. They may just like the food, or they might just like the music. They're not, you know, trying to represent what that person's, you know, arguable flaws are in terms of their own personal beliefs. But so we have to be careful with that. And that's what happens in every discussion, whether it's religion, politics, anything. You know, people have triggers now so easily that they will jump on another person as soon as they hear them mention a word or a term. And that doesn't represent the whole person. That just represents their feeling. And maybe they have reason to believe that it's valid. Maybe it's not what you think they mean. So again, it goes back to the discussion and the need to listen and not just wipe out. And that, to me, that's what canceling is. It's just completely ignoring. I'm also thinking of the statues. You know, that was a big deal recently. You know, the tearing down of statues, Confederate statues and things like that. Does doing that make the world a better place, even if you don't agree with what those people stood for? Or does leaving them up serve as a reminder to people of the importance of not following what they say, but remembering that this is an unfortunate part of our history, and we need to remember that and not erase it, because it doesn't make the racism or issues disappear by tearing down a statue. What it means is people kind of forget about it. This is serves as a trigger for discussion in a positive way, to keep people's, you know, keep the discussion going, rather than, again, taking sides and not refusing to do anything about it. So there's a lot to think about.
I have so many thoughts. One, I think me trying to dictate other people's actions and thoughts seems exhausting. And perhaps the question is, what am I going to do, right? And because everything is so subjective, we are looking for objectivity in things that are deeply subjective. And to the point of who gets to win, usually it's where the power is, or the loudest voices. And so we know that power, whatever that means for you, matters. And that's how things sometimes get determined. And sometimes it's a bunch of people that don't know each other that come and have voices and they get the thing taken down, or the person, you know, no one is ever going to listen to them again. Sometimes that's not what happens. To your earlier question, and I've been pondering it around being sensitive and the subjectivity of it all, it's interesting because sometimes there's not a line, or the line keeps moving. So where does canceling an individual become canceling an entire thing? And not that it will ever happen in America, but becomes canceling entire histories and books or things that we can or cannot read or no longer say because of these subjective matters. And so part of the issue is the line continues to move, And I don't know where that takes us, because what's not moving is our intentionality around getting to know other people and forming deep communities so that we're not just looking at abstractions, but we're dealing with humanity in the heart.
We're hoping it's moving, and that's why Village Square has small groups now.
We're hoping.
But can I just real quickly, like, it's really dangerous when this canceling happens at the government level, which you intimated without saying it in a way. Like, and let's not even say talk about today. Let's just think backwards, like McCarthyism, for example. So this is a very insidious and dangerous practice. And again, just to call it canceling someone is, it doesn't grasp what we're saying, really.
What? And to build on this, as a pastor, there's a few big picture things I'm trying to do and help the people in my church to do. I want them to make increasingly good choices that honor Jesus Christ and reflect him. I want people to increasingly learn to love other people as people that God has created, whether they agree with us on anything or not. I want people to have the wisdom to be able to correctly nuance what relationships and life ought to look like in a very pluralistic, diverse society. As a Christian, I want to create an environment where we're able to help one another do that. And I think that those kind of things, and I think in a way we're all trying to do that in our respective institutions, help. The problems come when we don't have those relationships, when we reduce people to their sound bites, when we reduce people to a particular choice that we disagree with, and in a way, reduce their humanity, who they are, and demand that they be who we think they ought to be. And if not, we're going to force them to be who they ought to be. Because I think one of the things we brought out, hopefully pretty clearly, is all of this is subjective. And so if we can't learn to live in an environment where there's all kinds of people who are going to disagree with us and say things that we don't agree with, I mean, that we're going to be hurting and hurting each other.
Okay, so where does forgiveness lie in all of this? What is your specific faith tradition's approach to forgiveness? Can a person, and I'm not necessarily thinking now, celebrity level, but if we're talking more community level, how does a person come back from, I don't like the word cancel either. I think we should cancel. How does a person come back from being in a position where they've transgressed?
So I've had an experience recently. Last year, there's some complicated decisions that were made at our church, and some people were really angry at me, and I feel like I've been canceled. You know what I mean? Never been canceled before, but if I see these people, I was at an event the other week, like at a party, so it's kind of intimate, I got a house, and these people showed up, and they wouldn't even look at me. I mean, they wouldn't even look at me. It was amazing. And these are Christians, okay? And I thought, I remember thinking, like, I wish they would just talk. Like, we could have a conversation. Like, you can totally disagree with me and not like me, but I'm going to be with this person for eternity. Hello. I'm going to be with this, and that's what I think, right? Is in my mind, as a Christian, I believe that I have a pretty wide, idea of salvation, and I think that, like, these people are going to be with me in heaven one day for eternity. That's a really long time. I don't know if you're aware of that. And, like, all of us probably, right? I believe that, and I hope that. And I don't want to be embarrassed about how I treated you later. And so I want to look at everybody with mercy, and I want to really kind of, I like what Solzhenitsyn said, that, like, the line of good and evil runs to the heart of every person, right? And all of us at times do things that we're regret and so on. And I think redemption should be possible for everyone. And there isn't a person who's just pure evil, very rarely, at least in my experience. Most people are trying to do good and trying to do well, and holding on to that and the value and the dignity of every human being helps me be merciful, right? And also knowing my own weaknesses, and my hope that people will accept me and not turn me away from my problems as well.
In Jewish tradition, certainly the idea is that repentance and forgiveness can happen at any time. There's no one time that it has to happen, but there are certain times or particularly a certain time set aside for, and that is during the High Holy Days, during Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And so there is an active process of repentance that people go through. And the idea of that is not to say you can't ask for forgiveness or forgive someone any other time, but we need a reminder on an annual basis, if not more often, that we need to take account of our actions and remember that. And one of the sayings that I like very much about Yom Kippur is that for sins between a person and God, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, atones. But for sins between a person and another person, it does not atone until you have made peace with the other person. Which means, you know, Judaism and certainly many other religions acknowledge that you can't just say, well, I'm sorry, and that's it, you know, or I, as was said before, I was in a bad mood, I was whatever, and I did it, and, you know, the idea, even though I don't take it literally, is that God, you know, takes account of every action we've made over the past year and forever, nothing is forgotten. So that, I like that idea, that we may think things are forgotten, but it never really is. So as far as forgiveness and repentance, it is important for us to understand that we should be open to forgiving ourselves, to forgiving others, but it can't just happen automatically. The person has to want to be forgiven. The person has to show remorse. They have to show change in behavior. It's not just saying something or going through, you know, the motions. You have to actually change your behavior. And if that's the case, then we should be open to forgiving others. But to just say, oh, everyone's forgiven, it doesn't work that way unless people are sincerely wanting it.
And just before, Latricia, before you speak, just to add on to what Rabbi's saying about Yom Kippur, there's a process for individuals, right, to go to people, and we actually say, I ask your forgiveness for anything that I may have done to cause you harm or pain intentionally or unintentionally, right? Because sometimes we transgress and we don't even know, and that's part of the forgiveness as well.
And as a Christian, I mean, forgiveness is central. It's key. It's everything. We believe that every human being is a sinner who has sinned against a holy God, and that God in Christ has taken that sin upon himself to free us from that. And that the moment we ask him, he forgives us. And then what does Jesus teach us over and over and over? If you have been forgiven much, you must forgive much. Lord, how often am I to forgive? You are to forgive 70 times 7. And obviously, that's not literal. On the 491st time, you don't just get to, that's right, I get to take care of that. We are to be forgiven people who know that we have been forgiven. That's the key to life together as a church, but we believe that that's the key to life together as human beings who are broken and sinful and need redemption and help from one another. There's a verse in James 2:13, that talks about how if we judge others without mercy, then our judgment will be merciless. And yet mercy triumphs judgment. And that's a reminder that the mercy of Christ triumphs any judgment that we might bring upon ourselves. But it's also a reminder to us that we are to treat others with mercy, not judgment, in each and every circumstance. And without that, life together really isn't possible.
I'd like to just one note. I'll be quick, I promise. Maybe there's a difference. I wonder if our English language, we use the word forgiveness, is a little bit limited. We can have different meanings and different conditions. But for me, my example is Jesus on the cross praying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. Those people didn't repent in that moment, but he still prayed for the mercy for them and forgiveness. And that's the attitude that I adopt. But there is something to be said for people who don't convert or repent or do something evil. And like, how do you forgive them? So I think there might be a limited language here, a limit in our language of expressing this. But for me, forgiveness, mercy is can be unrestricted in that way. But maybe there's another quality of forgiveness that requires someone actually being sorry to receive that as well.
So, yes, part of what I was going to raise is I do think that there is a difference when a process is being followed and someone is repentant and deeply sorrowful, and that's great, and it may make forgiveness easier, maybe, and what happens when it doesn't, and also remembering that forgiveness is not only a matter of the heart, it is also a process and its own process. And it doesn't mean that everything is just done. So even with the God forgive them for they know not what they are doing, don't cancel me when I say this or do. The way that I often think of it is, what if in the fullness part of his humanity, Jesus is saying, you know what? I don't know if I'm all the way ready to forgive yet, but Father, you forgive them for they know not what they are doing. What if that's one of the pieces and a step towards forgiveness until I get ready? The other part of that, and you may have heard me quote it before, because my personal thought is, God forgive them for they know not what they are doing, even when I think they exactly know what they are doing, because at our depths, we are too broken to know. So it doesn't mean that I necessarily excuse or any of those things, but I'm recognizing that in our collective brokenness, that is a deep part of the sadness of our humanity, where there is also joy, right? Some of us have experienced such brokenness that cannot be understood or ascertained, that the most humane and loving thing that we can do is say, I don't know why they're behaving this way. I don't know why they have these thoughts, because their thoughts are not my thoughts. And I can also say, forgive them even when I think they do know, because we are too broken to know. And that is, I think, the kind of forgiveness that we want of other people when we don't have the words in our brokenness to come out and explain all the things that are on the inside. But it's a really hard and spiritually mature thing to do that has love at its starting point.
And its ending point. And I'm thinking and looking at somebody that I'm thinking of about a panel that we did here, very powerful, years ago, around restorative justice. So I just wanted to throw out the words restitution and restoration as part of anything that leads to wholeness or is motivated by love and ends in love. And it's hard, and it's not just words.
Forgiveness costs. I mean, somebody can throw a brick through your window and you can forgive somebody. Somebody still has to pay for the window in order to fix it. Either that person will do that or you will have to do that. And that is a mature thing to move. And there's also, I think, an important distinction that we often miss. Betsy, you alluded to this, where forgiveness ought to lead toward restitution whenever possible. It ought to lead toward reconciliation whenever possible, but sometimes we know that there's only so much possible with us. But that, again, that comes back to what are we doing to try to move toward that the best that we can. But there is always a cost with that. And that's where, as a Christian, we fall back on, well, Jesus paid that infinite cost. We're able to pay that cost.
I think that also leads into the idea of there needs to be a balance between mercy and justice. And that, you know, the traditional Jewish teaching is when God came to create the world, God used equal amounts of justice and mercy in creating the world. And the analogy that's given is of a vessel that has both cold and hot water in it, extremely cold and extremely hot water. If you put too much cold water in the vessel, it will crack. If you put too much hot water in the vessel, it will crack. It needs a balance of both. And so when we talk about mercy, and I'm sure we generally would agree that mercy is a good thing, a positive thing, and we need to have more of it sometimes, we also can't forget the other side of justice and trying to find that balance. So as far as forgiveness goes, there needs to be forgiveness that is appropriate for that act or that person, but also a sense of trying to understand. And as was said, the way of putting it is ultimately only God can judge. We as human beings cannot, we can try our best to, you know, we have a legal system, we have legal authorities and so on. We have religious codes that we try to, all of us, practice as best we can without abusing our leadership and acting in what we think is the right way. But ultimately, I think we all know that we're flawed, and we have to ultimately recognize God as the authority. And so if you believe in the idea of an afterlife, that ultimately people are rewarded or punished accordingly, but everyone has the opportunity to seek forgiveness. So it's an important thing to realize while we have a responsibility to assure justice in the world and take care of each other, we also have a responsibility to not, you know, be the policing everybody.
Stephanie wanted me to stop you.
Stephanie's not alone, but yeah.
No, I just thank you, everyone. Thank you, Rabbi, for finishing up in a great space of Baruch Le'ana Emet, which is blessed be the one true judge. It's now time for questions, so that's why I wanted to make sure we stopped.
If you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll come around with the mic. We have a couple of volunteers that are also going to go ahead and pass out the post surveys.
Thank you all. Great discussion. I had a question about serving as a, whether it's a intermediary, a, you know, bystander, however you want to frame that position. But essentially, if you are seeing conflict that is leading to cancellation threats or, you know, that kind of behavior, either in person or online, how can you contribute in a positive way as kind of the third party that's observing? Is there a role to play, or are you like, hey, this is a dumpster fire, I got to get out of here? Or can you really, you know, is there a way for you to try to thoughtfully bring the parties to a more, at least, neutral and understanding space?
I think for me, if it is in front of me happening and it's people, right, that's one scenario where there can be a role. I tend to not jump into online things because I don't see that as real. I see that as a place where people like to just do the things, and it's not as meaningful, especially when it's not even anybody that I know. But if it's a situation that is right in front of me in the church, in the community, in the family, then there is an opportunity to kind of stand in the gap and help people to have conversations, right? We do it all the time to try to understand the sides and come to a thought. Online, it's a whole different thing that's happening on social media for me.
And to build on, I think that it comes back again to relationship. Right. Do you have the relationship with that person to be able to meaningfully, or are you going to inflame the situation? And while I would characterize online discourse a little differently, again, I would look at that in a way that it's very difficult to tamp down those type of discussions. In other words, our online discourse tends to reinforce that. And again, for the most part, I believe you have to have those kind of discussions offline. Again, that's going to come back to relationship. And that might mean reaching out and trying to begin a relationship if you feel that that's necessary. But that's going to be key for those type of discussions.
Okay. Thank you. So I've listened to you all talk about cancel culture, and much of what you've talked about is in the personal realm, you know, morality, personal morality. I'm in the university system, and so the way that I experience cancel culture is much more political. Okay. You know, talk about somebody, do something, give them room for restoration, redemption, that sounds great. But What do you do when you know the cancel culture is serving your political aim? How do you muster the moral fortitude to resist utilizing something that you know is wrong, but it achieves what you think of as God's work? So for instance, diversity is fine, but when you wrap it in something called wokeness, oh, you weaponized it now, and it's something very different that can achieve a different end. So what does the faith-leading community say to people employing cancel culture as a political strategy for political use when you know morally there's something wrong with the foundation of it?
I try to say something. It's a great question. I think we had an experience at FSU a couple years back. One of the students from my group actually got in some big trouble. It was all in the news. He was the president of the student senate, and he said some things in a private chat, and it was during a lot of the George Floyd protests and so on. It was a very emotionally charged time, and he said some things about the organization of Black Lives Matter supporting certain things that might be contrary to our faith. And it just suddenly, some people got offended, they blew it up, and he ended up being canceled. He later sued the university, and I guess he won, but let me just say this. There was two things I observed. On the one hand, he sat, and he heroically did this, he sat there and took a lot of abuse. These students came at him, they cussed at him, they called him names, there was hatred, and that's not justice, right? I don't think that's justice. On the other hand, I think that students have a right to have whoever they want representing them in the Senate. So if, like, you know, they found out this guy believes this or that, like, they have the freedom to choose somebody different. So how do you do that? I think you have to have the courage. And I think I've seen on both sides, I think the left gets more attention for being cancel culture, but I see it all the time on the right side as well. And it's funny how blind we are that people who are against cancel culture will then quickly say, can you believe, like they'll say to me, can you believe Notre Dame let this guy speak? He believes in this and this and this. Like, there's a big uproar when President Obama spoke at Notre Dame some years ago. They should not allow him and so on. These are the same people who complain about cancel culture. So I think we have to have some real values and real self-discernment and real honesty and humility that we don't, it's not just about power or who's in charge, but are we really seeking the good and the truth and not just, you know, what my ideology or my politics says?
It's much easier said than done, but I would say that what we need to do is to try our best to make sure there's moral equivalence, if that's the right term. So for example, I'll broach a very sensitive topic as a rabbi and as a Jew. On campuses all over, there is such horrible vitriol against Israel being spouted by students and ignored or supported by leaders, professors, and I've seen screenshots of assignments to talk about how Israel is imperialist and all this. You know, I'm the first to say I don't agree with everything that the current Israeli government is doing. And I have a lot of sympathy for innocent Palestinians in Gaza. But when people are screaming from the river to the sea in on campus, which means wipe out Israel and all Jews, that is, and they're saying Israel's committing genocide and apartheid, which is wrong, that they're saying that, and then at the same time advocating for genocide. That's wrong. So we need to do that. However, if someone, a Jewish student or professor or anyone on campus, got up and spouted such vitriol the other way, that has to be spoken up against. And it's okay to stand up and say, I support the rights of Palestinians, I support the people of Gaza, and so on. It's not okay to say, wipe out Israel, all Jews are terrible, all these things. And to have university leadership support that is absolutely despicable. But there has to be fair. And so I'm not saying don't allow people to get up and protest for Palestinian rights or protest the war. They're entitled to their opinion and they have valid points. But they shouldn't be taken to the extreme, and neither should people supporting Israel do anything extreme to to show their support. And that there should be, what should be happening in, on these campuses is the encouragement of dialogue, because people would find they have a lot more in common than they think. But instead, there's you know, I'm waiting for violence to break out. It's terrible. So we to answer your question more directly, we need to stand up for the rights of people to speak and not say inappropriate things, even if it's not in favor of what we're saying. It has to be fair across the board.
Patricia, go ahead. And then one more question.
I also think that because you're asking, like, what will we do? Like, we're up here representing members of the God Squad. I think one of the things we can do is influence the spaces in which we serve to help people to towards human flourishing in a way that doesn't see itself as always having to take a side, but to say, what does human flourishing look like? And I think that we are really bad at doing that. And yes, it does definitely take courage, maybe, or just the willingness to be that kind of voice. And sometimes we say that things are not political, like the church shouldn't be political, this shouldn't be political. And I remember being in graduate school, and I forgot who actually coined this definition of politics, but it is who gets what, when, and how. Who gets what, when, and how. And when I understood that definition, what I understood is that even though we politicize the term political, right, that so many things actually are, and Jesus actually influenced who gets what, when, and how, and challenged how we understood that. Challenged and often flipped scripts and tables to challenge how we understand who gets what, when, and how. And so when we can speak towards that from a space of human flourishing, I think we're at least towards the right track.
Thanks. So one final question.
One quick question right up front. I'll hold
it for you. Oh, thanks. Okay, two thoughts. First of all, when you read the definition, I immediately was taken aback, because in those words, what we're saying is when something is offensive, and I was so glad you started talking about subjectivity, because that is the major thing we're missing. When something is perceived to be offensive by you, in your belief system, in your way of thinking, then that's up to you to determine, as you were saying, how you respond. And you were very eloquent in stating that. So I really appreciated you to keep repeating subjectivity, subjectivity. The second thing was, I think, Rabbi Paul, you spoke about when you were talking about forgiveness, and you said something along the lines, and I'm not quoting you, that a person has to want to be forgiven. I think that we have to realize, again, we may think they need to be forgiven, and they may think, I'm perfectly fine. I don't need forgiveness. So, you know that old saying about not forgiving is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die? So we have to take care of ourselves. So our perception is always, you know, that subjectivity. We have to go, I'm going to let you have your journey so that I can have mine. So the whole idea of one person or one movement or one belief saying, this is right, this is wrong, that's where we have to stop, and the critical thinking and the conversations have to take place.
I appreciate your comment. I'll talk to address the second part. While I'm not going to change or say that I do believe that a person needs to want to be forgiven, I do agree with what you're saying in terms of saying forgiveness is for the forgiver even more than the forgiven. And I absolutely hold that to that and agree. So in that, to that extent, I agree with what you're saying, and I didn't mean to imply that, but I do think it is important for the person who has done something wrong, even if they don't believe they did, to seek forgiveness from the other person for having harmed them, as we said, intentionally or unintentionally, because there was a misunderstanding. And maybe the way they can do it is to have a dialogue and clarify. I've certainly done that in my life, where people have been very upset with me for something I never said or did, but they heard that I did or misinterpreted, and I sit down with them and I talk about it, and they come to realize. And of course, there are times when I actually did something that was wrong, and I asked for forgiveness for that. But it's important that's why the dialogue is important. But yes, I think that it is important to forgive, even if the person isn't necessarily repentant. You can try to talk to them, but if they're not, yeah, you're going to eat yourself up inside if you don't forgive them. So for your sake, and if not for theirs, you need to do that. So I agree.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, I'm sure many of you that would agree that this is my favorite way to start the weekend. So let's give it up for our God Squad. They were awesome.
Corey Nathan back here with you, and I am grateful everyone is not canceled and that you were able to listen in on this important conversation with the God Squad. Yeah, I was leaning forward right from the get-go. And when Stephanie asked who gets canceled, what gets canceled, after listening to all of our wonderful panelists, I was thinking, you know, we have a much better, much more trustworthy way of actually canceling people when appropriate. And here in America, we've been working on it and evolving those ways for almost 250 years. So no, I am not in favor of canceling or what I am talking about is the U.S. Constitution, specifically the First Amendment, just as an example, the freedom of speech, the right to assemble, the freedom of the press. Those, you know, there's the five basic freedoms that are memorialized in the First Amendment. And we've been working this out for quite some time. You know, I think this country historically has done a miraculous job at protecting those rights, even and especially when someone's speech expresses a different belief than our own. Like what comes to mind is the National Socialist Party of America versus Skokie, Illinois, a very famous Supreme Court case that came before the SCOTUS in 1977. Who was it that defended the American Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois? It was the lawyers of the ACLU who happened to be Jewish. So it went to the Supreme Court, like I said, and those brilliant lawyers who argued that case said that, why did they take that case? Why did they defend the American Nazis, Jewish attorneys? And they said, our First Amendment rights aren't tested when we agree with the speech, but when we disagree, even disagree passionately with the speech that's when those rights are tested. So we have to protect speech and assembly and the press, especially when we disagree. Now, obviously, there are limitations. And I think there have been times when the courts have gotten it wrong, to be fair, historically. But over the long haul, we bend toward justice. And as was said in this talk, we shouldn't have to be afraid of one's thoughts. Those who break the law, part of which is abridging my rights, whether by violence or other means, that's one of those limitations. But our judicial branch has done a pretty good job, at least over the long haul, of meeting all of this out. Again, the arc of freedom bends toward justice. Something else that really resonated was the concept of stacking assumptions, or Mani Guzman would call this chaining. So what's an example? If I know you listen to Taylor Swift, Tay Tay. Or actually, I should tell you, I went to a local pub with my brother. We were going to listen to some music, and I overheard this little mini argument over Bud Light. Bud Light! Dude's like, what do you want to drink that crap for? It was like a little mini canceling. And I, like right there, like the troublemaker in me, I just felt like ordering around a Bud Lights for everybody, blasting some Tay Tay over the loudspeakers, and I don't know, playing with a Barbie doll right there at the bar. But the concept is stacking assumptions or chaining. You know, just because I order a Bud Light, this fella stacks the assumption that all kinds of other things that he doesn't know, but he knows that enough to know he doesn't like it, based on Bud Light and Taylor Swift. Sorry, you got a snort out of me over Tay Tay. But since this is a God Squad, I'll say one other thing. I love every time Latricia talks, all of these speakers, but I always find myself like really tuning in to when Latricia is speaking. Latricia mentioned toward the end about Jesus and his full humanity. I love how Latricia allowed for us to imagine the humanity of Jesus. And listen, whether you're a Christian or not, just as such a huge figure historically, imagining this epic figure, imagining his humanity in terms of his frailty. And like a lot of us, not knowing if we have the strength to forgive someone, not knowing if we have it in us to forgive. So he calls on a higher power to ask to forgive them, for they know not what they do. And you know, for the purposes of this conversation, what that got me thinking about is that God's not worried about being canceled, you know? So like it was said toward the end there, one of the best things we can do if we disagree with someone's speech or something they've written, if they're drinking Bud Light or listening to Tay Tay, or even if you don't have the strength to forgive, maybe we can just get to the table and have some dialogue and at least try to better understand, try to clarify, try to understand how someone could not like Barbie or Bud Light or Bud Light drinking Barbie or I don't know. Anyway, you know what I mean. So with that, it's time to close out today. Please consider joining our members and supporting this programming. You can become a member for just $7 a month or $76 a year, and your business can join for $250. Go to villagesquare.us/donate to join today. And while you're there, sign up for Village Square's newsletter to stay up to date with everything happening at the Village Square. Go to villagesquare.us and scroll to the bottom for that sign up box. Funding for this podcast was provided through a grant from Florida Humanities with funds from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program about Taylor Swift, Bud Light, or Bobby, sorry, or anything else, do not necessarily represent those of Florida Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We appreciate you listening to Everyone is Canceled with our beloved God Squad. So until next time, we challenge you to reach out with an open heart and mind to someone who doesn't look or think like you. It changes everything. We'll talk to you soon, and thanks so much for listening to Village Squarecast.